Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, ladies and gents, to the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm your host, Julian Klimochko. I'm here with my co-host, Mike Kesslering. And on today's podcast, we welcome special guest Pat Roney, CEO and founding partner of Vintage Wine Estates, one of the fastest growing wine producers in the U.S. Vintage Wine Estates recently announced a business combination with Canadian SPAC Bespoke Capital Acquisition Corp in a deal that values the business at an enterprise value of $690 million. On the podcast, Pat discusses what attracted him to the wine business and why he believes it will continue to grow, the economics of selling wine and the importance of various price points in a product suite, the outlook for M&A at the company, background on the company's merger with Canadian SPAC Bespoke Capital Acquisition Corp, his personal favorite bottle of wine, and more. So with no further ado, here's our podcast with Pat Roney, CEO and founding partner of Vintage Wine Estates. Welcome, Pat, to the Absolute Return Podcast. Pretty excited to have you on the show today. This is our first show about wine, so I'm excited to get into it. I'm a bit of a fan, but certainly no expert as you are. I mean, you've been in the wine business for decades. Checking out your career history, you've really spent most of your career in wine and spirits with a number of different wineries prior to striking it out on your own like a couple decades ago already. So first off, I wanted to get your thoughts on why you've stayed in the wine business so long. Obviously, you like it. There's some appeal for you there. What has attracted you to the wine business and, you know, led you to basically committing your whole career to it?
Well, thanks, Julian, for letting me spend some time to visit with you and kind of talk about Vintage Wine Estates and the wine industry in general. And yeah, I actually worked my way through college in the wine business in the restaurant in Chicago with the pump room and learned a lot about wines in the process. And I just always felt that the wine industry was kind of interesting. I started in sales and moved my way into marketing and worked for a lot of great companies like Seagram's and their wine division and Christian Brothers out in California, and eventually was president of Chateau St. Jean and president of Cundy and got involved in the acquisition of Girard Winery. And then we started Vintage Wine Estates in 2007. And for me, it's always been an industry that, it's a business at the end of the day. It's still a business side of it, but it's got a lot of complexities to it. And it's ag-based and it's consumer-based. And we've been fortunate to be able to grow and do well in the wine business.
I wanted to get into some of the basics of the wine business. So obviously we as consumers, we only know one side of it, but don't really know too much about everything that goes into it from, the wineries and, growing, processing, all the way up to, offering products at different price points and really how you guys grow on the consumer side and then everything from that to consolidation, M&A, and things of that nature. So can you walk us through, some of the basics behind your operations?
No, absolutely. And yeah, as you mentioned, Julian, it really is. It's an ag-based business. We grow crops and we harvest grapes and we're subject to some of the conditions of the ag market. But some years we have large harvests, some years we have small harvests, but we always work through that. And we look in the industry, we look at various segments of the industry. There's the $10 and below category, which is the value kind of part of the wine business. We don't tend to do too much in that category. This is very high volume driven. It's low margin, very capital intensive on that part of the business. And then we're in what we kind of the premium category in the $10 to $20 primarily. We're almost 79% of our business is sold in those price points. In Canada, of course, that would be a little bit higher price points. And then about 20% of our business is the $20 plus category. And we like those segments of the business because they're a little more profitable and not quite as capital intensive as you go in the various segments. And So when we look at the industry in general, it is a fragmented industry. In the United States, there's over 10,000 wineries just in the United States. And we've seen a lot of consolidation as a result of that, because the distributors have gone from, you know, over 4,000 distributors to less than 700 distributors. And as they consolidate, they're telling a lot of small to mid-sized wineries that don't have a home for them anymore. And so it creates kind of channel conflict strategies in that. And then, you know, the wholesale business represents what gets sold to the grocery stores, to the restaurants across the country. But in the wine business, there's also the opportunity to do the direct-to-consumer, which is a big part of our business. Almost 30% of our business is sold off of e-commerce or through our wine clubs or through our tasting rooms. And that allows for a lot more direct relationships with our customers, and we like that. And then we also have almost 30% of our business in the B2B segment, which is really custom production for other, you know, wine brands, as well as it is exclusive relationships, exclusive brands with some of the major retailers, whether it's Costco or Trader Joe's or BevMo or Safeway Albertsons or Kroger's. So we do a lot of that too. So our business is highly diversified in those three segments, or those three go-to-market kind of categories. But the majority of the wholesale, the business, most wineries are, you know, 95% plus in wholesale and a little bit of direct-to-consumer. The larger you go up in volume, or the more you focus on the sub-$10 category, you're even less than the direct-to-consumer side. So with our business being diversified and both a channel platform as well as highly focused on the $10 plus category, we have lots of opportunities to continue to look at the business and grow, and opportunities to make acquisitions in the wine industry. We've made over 20 acquisitions of wineries in the last 10 years. We're really one of the most acquisitive companies in the industry. And we think that there's going to continue to be opportunities to make acquisitions and grow our business, not only organically, but grow it through acquisitions as well.
And from a macro perspective, just going through your investor presentation, it seems like there's strong tailwinds behind the wine business. For example, you mentioned 50 years of consistent growth, total U.S. wine consumption. And then another interesting factoid is per capita wine consumption in the U.S. is actually significantly lower than some European countries. Can you give us a bit of a perspective on some of the tailwinds driving the business?
Yeah, you bet. And there are very strong tailwinds in the category. Over the last 25 years, the total market has doubled. Over the last 50 years, it's quadrupled. Yet we're still very, very low in per capita consumption compared to Europeans. We're almost a third of what they are. And we think that as consumers continue to premiumize, that per capita consumption is going to go up a little bit. And we think there are very, very good tailwinds in the category. And it's a $45 billion category that's been around for thousands of years, and it has continued to demonstrate growth. And I think that's going to continue in the category. And the price points that we're playing in, the $10 plus category, it's been on a compounded annual growth rate of over 6%, and we think that that's going to continue. And we like that. We like that stability in that segment.
So you mentioned the 6% compound annual growth rate, and then looking at Vintage Wine Estates specifically, since 2010, 20% revenue CAGR, 24% EBITDA CAGR. What has led to the company's above market growth rates? And specifically, I noticed that you guys even grew throughout the recession. What strategies helped drive growth throughout that difficult period?
Yeah, so we certainly have grown through every recession since 2002, and we've even grown during the pandemic here in the United States. It was also, in a worldwide basis, very challenging. And, you know, what has led that growth for us has been the ability to do innovation in our brands, the ability to make strategic acquisitions, and have a very focused part of growth on the direct consumer and the B2B segments, which are growing faster than the overall wholesale market. So, you know, as a company, while we're in the top 15 largest wine companies in California, we're still relatively small with a market share of less than 1.5%. So we have a lot of growth opportunities available to us without really being disruptive into the category to grow a little bit of share. And so we think that those opportunities are there, and that growth will come organically through innovation, and it'll come just from the growth in the category, and it'll come from acquisitions.
I always find it fascinating when you're in the wine store at a restaurant, you know, why some wines are $150 per bottle and some are $10 per bottle. And you seem to have products everywhere in between that. So clearly there's a method to the madness there. Can you explain a bit your pricing strategy? And maybe before getting into that, just from a, you know, top-down basis, how does the market in general, how does this industry price its products? Because I could never really figure it out. There seem to be award-winning wines that are maybe $20 and then some that are perhaps 10 times the price that don't taste all that much different, although perhaps it's just my palate that could use a little work.
So, Julian, I'll let you in on a little secret. I can't tell the difference either.
Okay, good to know.
I think a lot of it... When you get the $10 plus category, there's a lot of very, very good wines out there. There's no question about it. And for the vast majority of consumers, they can't really differentiate between a $10 and a $100 bottle of wine. And a lot of people in the industry can't really differentiate. I think that if you're going to look in the, you know, the $10 to $20 price point, you know, you might not use as many oak barrels in the $20 category. You're going to use smaller oak barrels in making your wines. But once you get beyond a $40 versus a $100 bottle, I mean, yeah, there certainly can be differences. But a lot of it is marketing, and a lot of it is prestige in the areas. Napa Valley is going to command a premium to most other areas in California just because it's Napa, and they've done a good job with their branding. Then there's, you know, the supply and demand side. I mean, some of the really, you know, really super geeky, hard, sought after wines that make 400 cases a year or 600 cases a year that sell for $400, $500, $600 a bottle. There's just not much of it. And there's enough people out there that will buy it just because they can. But as you go down on the price point and the volumes increase, you know, you're going to see more competition based upon what market pricing parameters can do and your competitive set and all the other brands that are out in the market. I mean, at any given time, the consumer is going to have over, you know, 250,000 choices of different wines to pick in the United States, just because different vintages, different grapes, different wine types, and so many wineries on a worldwide basis that are in the market competing. So it's a variety of factors, but I think there's a lot to be said for the $10 to $40 category of wines. You can't really go wrong.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest-growing alternative investment solution providers, with a suite of institutional-caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance. The Accelerate Arbitrage Fund, symbol ARB on the TSX, is the world's first SPAC-focused ETF, with a diversified portfolio of SPAC and merger arbitrage opportunities in an easy-to-use, low-cost ETF. The Accelerate Arbitrage Fund ETF trades under the symbol ARB on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
So moving outside of the different categories, when you look at the economics of your business under the direct-to-consumer versus the B2B segment, how do those underlying economics differ for those two different channels?
So when you look at them, it's interesting because the direct to consumer is the highest gross margin category at almost 59% gross margin, and the B2B is the lowest gross margin category for us. It's at around 30% gross margin. But the difference is that, you know, when the DTC and the wholesale, you have higher selling expenses and higher marketing expenses to apply against those. So the net of it is all three of the channels of all three legs of our stool really deliver pretty close to the same kind of EBITDA margins at the end of the day. And the B2B side of it, you get your stickiness from the fact that you either have contracts, and whether you're producing the wine for people or, you know, long-term contracts with selling in the wine. And in other cases, we own the trademarks and we develop the brands and the stories for the major retailers. They're buying it not because they're looking for the best price, but they're looking for great quality and consistency and packaging, and they're looking for scores, which we get them from the major wine writers. And so it's a combination of all of those factors. And the direct consumer side is is actually growing very, very well now, especially during the pandemic. We saw almost a 10-year growth in eight months in the category, where more consumers were learning how easy it was to order wine online. And I don't think that is going to change. I think we're going to continue to support that. I think that's interesting. In the U.S., where we can see the metrics, the average price per bottle that was purchased online actually went down, which really makes sense to me, because it just said more consumers are coming into the market and more consumers are now ordering wines online that are, you know, $15 a bottle or 12 instead of 60 or 70. So it changed the dynamics of that segment of the market.
Yeah, clearly it's becoming somewhat of a scale business. You mentioned right. A ton of wineries out there, 10,000 in the U.S., which is one reason I assume that you guys are pursuing an active M&A strategy, picking up a number of wineries over history. And I assume you also plan on picking that up once you complete this recently announced going public transaction. So I just wanted to get a sense of what your thoughts are behind your acquisition strategy and really where you see yourself driving value from those acquisitions. Is it more of just a synergy play, a scale play?
It's largely a synergy and scale play for us. We have historically, and we will continue to take, a very disciplined approach to how we look at acquisitions. I typically look at 40 to 60 acquisitions a year. We typically write 6 LOIs, and we typically close on 2 to 3 acquisitions per year. But we don't chase the high flyers. We don't chase things that are 22, 24 times EBITDA, that you have to grow your business 300 or 400% before you even think about a return on your invested capital. We look at opportunities where, you know, the banks or the seller thinks that they're getting an 8 to 12 times multiple of EBITDA. And I know on a post-close basis, we're paying 4 to 6 times EBITDA for that business, because we have synergies in our bottling operations and synergies in our purchasing operations. We consolidate all of the back office G&A, and we normally consolidate the wholesale sales and in the e-commerce wine club team. We typically keep, when they have tasting rooms, we typically keep that. We always keep a distinct winemaker associated with every winery, so they can continue, you know, the DNA of what developed that winery and these kinds of things. Sometimes we keep the owners. In the case of Kendi Estate Winery, we're keeping the fourth generation family members who are now joining Vintage Wine Estates as shareholders, and some of the next generation will be involved in the business. So every winery has a unique story. Every winery has a unique opportunity. But in our growth plans, we've actually modeled the growth plan just based on one acquisition a year, which is very conservative for us, because we will do 2 or 3 acquisitions. So before we announced the IPO, I had 14 active acquisitions on my desk. We had another 10 inbound for people saying, hey, you're going public. We'd like to talk to you about selling our winery. So the pipeline is very, very active. The opportunities are very active. But we'll continue to stay disciplined in the approach as to how we look at it. The one thing that may change, because we will have a fair amount of capital and a fortress level balance sheet with no net debt, is that, you know, we might increase the size of some of the acquisitions. Instead of $10 to $40 million acquisitions, we might be $40 million to $100 million acquisitions, maybe some in the $200 million range. But that'll just help us grow faster. But the disciplines associated with those acquisitions will be the same.
In terms of the 20 plus acquisitions that you have carried out already and successfully integrated, as you had mentioned, are there any that in particular that really stand out, that really highlight your process of acquiring companies?
Sure, Mike, great question. I can talk about a few of those. I mean, one was the acquisition we did of Firesteed Winery. And in the case of Firesteed, as we see a lot of this, it was owned by an individual who didn't have an exit strategy, who was running it as a small business, didn't have a next generation to pass it down to. Basically bought his business, which was doing 40,000 cases at the time, bought it for inventory value so he could get his cash out of the business. And now 2.5 years later, 2 price increases and a package refresh later, we're doing over 100,000 cases a year on our system, and it's dramatically grown the business. It's one of our top 5 brands now. And slightly different one was Cameron Hughes, where we bought it, the prepackaged bankruptcy. You know, they're actually losing money at the time, and we shed their unprofitable wholesale business just to focus on their direct-to-consumer, which now drives over $12 million in revenue and highly profitable. And BR Cone was one where we bought out of the prepackaged bankruptcy, that we bought it for net asset value. And again, we refocused it back on direct consumer and taking them out to grocery stores. Great little Sonoma Valley winery, and now it's one of our top five fastest selling brands. So we have we look at a range, but we always look at those opportunities where we can see the potential for growth, but more importantly, cost consolidation to make the brands immediately profitable. We don't make any acquisition that we anticipate losing money on. It. It's just not the style that we're looking for.
I wanted to get into the recent news. So congrats on the recently announced business combination with Canadian SPAC Bespoke Capital Acquisition Corp. This deal actually valued Vintage Wine Estates at an enterprise value of $690 million. So the first thing I was wondering about this transaction is, what was the thesis, the strategy in choosing to go public? Is this going to give you a key competitive advantage, as you indicated, in M&A, if potential targets see that you have a liquid currency in order to make more larger acquisitions? Was that one of the main drivers?
That was the main driver. We've been very, very fortunate to borrow capital from our lending group at a very, very low cost. But that, at some point, you have to reload the coffers and for additional growth. And while we could continue to make smaller acquisitions and grow the business, the opportunity to bring that much capital in was the key driver. And that we were looking at the traditional way IPOs, and then we talked to a few other SPACs, but when we met the Bespoke guys, it just made a lot of sense, because with $360 million of capital, it was really, and knowing that we would bring it in was a good thing. But more importantly, they had a great management group. I mean, with Paul, Paul Walsh is who's coming on as our non-executive chairman of the board, 13 years with Diageo, and we created $80 billion of shareholder value there. And we were kind of running a page out of his playbook, which was growth through premiumization, growth through innovation, and growth through strategic acquisitions. And so that made a lot of sense for us. And he fit our corporate culture as well, with a very humble and modest man, and it made a lot of sense to us. And then there were two other gentlemen, Rob and Mark, that also were going to join our board of directors. And they were a six-year investor in Invention, one of the world's largest closure companies in the wine industry. So they understood the industry, and they had a lot of worldwide connections with major groups, which made a lot of sense for us. And so it was the combination of having a lot of firepower ready to make a lot of acquisitions during a tough time in the market with the pandemic, and having the ability to continue to grow. So it's a $200 million revenue company today. I don't see any reason why we can't get to $500 million revenue fairly quickly, and ultimately $1 billion of revenue in the not too distant future. And we think those are opportunities that are there for us.
And now a word from our sponsor, Accelerate, one of Canada's most innovative and fastest growing alternative investment solution providers. With a suite of institutional caliber alternative ETFs for investors seeking diversification and long-term performance, the Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF, symbol 1C, ONEC on the TSX, is Canada's first alternatives portfolio solution, providing exposure to 6 alternative asset classes, 10 alternative strategies in one easy-to-use, one-choice ETF that charges a management fee of just 0.2%. The Accelerate One Choice Alternative Portfolio ETF trades under the symbol 1C, ONEC on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. Certainly doesn't seem too far out of one's imagination, just given how highly fragmented this industry is, and just the amount of roll-up and consolidation opportunities. I'm always interested in hearing some of the background behind some of the deals, the transactions, and this one specifically with Bespoke Capital. How did this deal come about? You indicated you were considering a going public transaction, perhaps a traditional IPO. Was there inbound interest from SPACs, because there's quite a few out there, or was it an outbound initiative? You're talking to different ones. And what exactly made Bespoke stand out? Was it just their knowledge of the business, the fact that they're joining on as, board level type roles?
Yeah, it was all inbound business. We weren't actively seeking a SPAC. We were talking to different groups, but you know, the process when you get ready to do an IPO, you always have investment bankers and they're always looking at opportunities. And, you know, the Bespoke team had pivoted from investments in Canada and in cannabis because they just couldn't find the right opportunities for them and to broaden their horizon on how they were looking at things. And obviously they all had experience in, you know, wine and spirits and beer, and they were recommended to us. And, you know, that's just, we met and sat down and we really thought it made a lot of sense for us. That's how that kind of came about.
All right. So fast forward, this deal closes. You guys are up and trading as a publicly traded pure play wine company. Now, contrast to me going to a restaurant, looking at the wine menu, there's seemingly hundreds of choices. There aren't a lot of public wine companies out there. I noticed in your investor presentation, you compare not a lot of comparables. So you're looking at various spirits companies, beer companies, but these tend to be like very large consolidators out there. So what's your strategy on standing out in a crowded stock market just against some of these large, you know, jumbo cap spirit and beer consolidators? You know, what's unique about your story that will grab investor attention?
Well, I think the fact that we're a pure play wine company will grab a lot of investors' attention. We do sell a little bit of spirits, but it's primarily in our exclusive brand category, which is really, you know, more B2B. And we do that for relations we have with those people. But I think that the fundamentals of the business will show good value and good growth opportunity and a good investment for people to get in at a relatively low price earnings growth ratio, incredibly low. And fortunately for us, you know, the Duckhorn Group out of Napa just went public today, as a matter of fact. And they will show a good comparable, and they're a solid company with a lot of great brands. But we, you know, we'll look in a comparison. We'll look at a much better value than what they will. And there'll be more opportunities for people to look and understand the wine industry in general, I think. You know, we'll quickly be able to demonstrate that we can continue to grow at a very, very fast rate. Unfortunately, with these SEC regulations and everything else, I'm not allowed to buy anything until we close. I have to sit on the sidelines for a bit, but we have our sights on a few things, so we'll be fairly active after the anticipated close of the IPO in mid-May.
That's great to know, and you've spoke a lot about the story, the market, the products, the going public transaction, the M&A strategy. I wanted to put you on the spot on something else, specifically now that we have you on the line and can pick your brain. What is your favorite wine, or do you have a specific one that you like to recommend?
So, you know, it's interesting, Julian. I tell people that the wines are like your children. You know, some days they're behaving good and sometimes they're not. And sometimes, you know, you like one better than the other. I historically am more of a red wine blend person or a Cabernet. I like some great Pinots too. And, you know, just how I do my acquisitions, I'm the same way when I buy a bottle of wine. I'm a deep value guy. I want to say, what wine can I pick that I know I'm getting the best deal? And it's harder to do in a lot of restaurants in particular, but I'll look either, you know, to buy, you know, wines from our own wineries first, and if I don't see any of those in the restaurants or the stores, and I look for wines that are owned by my friends. I like, I share a bottle of wine that one of my friends made and send them a picture saying, you know, show that we're doing that. But I think in general, there's some wonderful, then the reds, Cabernets and Pinots and Zins that are out there. And on the whites, you know, it's hard to go wrong with Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and some of the major varietals. You know, we like some of the esoterics too, like the Albarinos and, you know, the Verdicchios and some of the others, but largely, you know, we're the main opportunities and main choices.
So in terms of deep value, what should a consumer expect in terms of price level when, you know, targeting these select wines?
Well, I think in you're in the $15 to $20 range, you can see a lot of deep value with that. And I can also tell you the other deep value play for investors that choose to buy some of the vintage wine estate stock if they're U.S. based, and we can't do it to other countries because of the export laws, but we're going to have a shareholder passport program where they're going to get discounts on their wine purchasing from our direct consumer, our websites, based upon the amount of shares that they own. So that'll be kind of fun. So we like that. I think we've already got some signed up.
Well, that sounds like a great bonus for shareholders there. Definitely.
And the shareholder parties. Those will be legendary.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm sure those will be a great time and well-stocked with wine, no doubt. Prior to wrapping things up, Pat, where can investors or even potential customers find out more about the company and your products?
So they can go to our website, vintagewineestates.com, and there's a tab there for investor information, and they can see the book and some additional information on that. And it'll also share, share the web addresses for all of our various wineries. Most of the information on a particular winery, like the Girard Winery, is going to be girardwinery.com. And we like to keep the integrity of each of the wineries of their own, standalone, and so people can have that one-on-one relationship with each individual winery. But as a whole, the entire company is listed and it's available at vintagewineestates.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you for your time today, Pat. It was an enjoyable conversation. You got exciting things happening at Vintage Wine Estates, both on the corporate side and, of course, the product side. Always happy to chat about wines. I learned a lot. So I want to thank you for coming on the show and wish you the best of luck in the going public transaction and everything in the future.
Thanks very much, Julian. Thank you, Mike. And hopefully we can get you both out to Napa or Sonoma sometime and share a glass of wine with us. And you can see, learn a little bit more about the experience with Vintage Wine Estates.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you for the invite.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty expressed or implied is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.